tonight, huh? Drummer? Come on, you.
Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, whatever you're listening to us. You're listening to the Drunken UX Podcast, and I am one of your hosts. I, of course, am the ever-exuberant Michael Feenan.
And I'm the less exuberant Aaron Hill. Thanks for joining us tonight.
We got to come up with a better tagline for you, man. Less exuberant sounds just not as exciting.
Well, give me a few drinks, so I'll become more exuberant.
I want to thank our sponsors who make the Drunken UX podcast possible over at New Cloud. You can check them out at newcloud.com/drunkenux. That is nucloud.com. Otherwise, let me see what else. I'm Michael Feeney. He's Aaron Hill. We got New Cloud as a sponsor. Oh, run by Facebook, Twitter. You can check us out at /drunkenux at either of those places and keep up with us. We retweet stuff. We share stuff. We let you know about things going on. Schedule changes, things of that nature. So be sure to stop by if you want to check us out on Slack and talk to us, especially after today's episode. We would love to hear what you're doing for security purposes and things like that. So if you run by either, you know, hit us on Slack at drunkenux.com/slack or leave a comment in our show notes or tweet at us, Facebook at us, whatever. I don't care. I just want to hear from you because that is super, super duper exciting for me.
So Michael, I heard a lot of liquid getting poured earlier. What are you drinking tonight?
Michael is, okay, so I've got a slightly pulled oblique muscle from hauling boxes at a conference, and so I'm a little sore, and so I'm self-medicating this evening with a glass of scotch. And when I say a glass, I don't mean, like, you know, a finger or two fingers of scotch. I mean a glass of scotch. This is a Speyburn 10. It's a Highland scotch. I don't know much about it. Somebody gifted this to me at some point, and I don't remember who. It may have been my brother-in-law. I don't entirely remember. It's got very interesting reviews. There are a lot of folks who say it's a really good value. On the nose, it smells a little bit like sweaty socks, so I'm not entirely convinced that it's good yet, but I'm going to give it a fair shake, and by the end of this show, you'll probably know how good it is by how good I feel. I haven't even seen your glass yet. What are you drinking over there?
I have another TNT, Tangerine Tonic, with a giant ice cube that I got these, I say a garage sale or something, and I got one of those silicon cube trays. The cubes are like 2 or 3 inches across. It takes like a day and a half to freeze.
No kidding, though, because I got, I do the Reddit gift exchange every year for Christmas. And the guy who had me as his secret Santa, that's what he gave me, was one of those. It's like the red silicone big.
They're amazing, aren't they?
Oh, I love it. In fact, that's what I'm using here. I've also got some of the spheres, too.
I have those, too.
The big spheres. So, yeah, I never need for. And with this scotch, I've got a feeling the ice is going to come in handy. So
what I found, I just have a giant plastic box in my freezer. And I just make the cubes, I guess, like you would do with normal cubes, but you have to be like, because it takes so long to freeze, you have to do it more often.
Yeah, you just don't drink enough. That's all that means. If you can save time. So today is a special episode, of course. We have found that bringing people onto the show is a fun, exciting experience. And so we thought, hey, we want to talk a little bit about the basics of web security. Who do we know that knows anything about web security? And my great friend and Aaron's kind of friend, Chris Wigman, is on mic number 3 this evening. Chris, thank you very much for joining us this evening. And I see that you also have a bottle on your table.
I do. Thanks for having me. And nothing as fancy as scotch or anything that requires an ice cube. But I got a nice Weissstefaner, Hefeweizen. So nice classic beer, seemed appropriate.
Isn't there something special about that particular brewery?
Supposedly, they build themselves as the oldest brewery in the world since 1040.
That's so impressive.
Coming up on I don't know how accurate that is, but they're coming up on their proclaimed 1,000th anniversary in our lifetimes.
I feel like there are some monks in one of those abbeys that would have something to say about that. Isn't there one of those that they make a bottling of beer like every year, and there's only a few hundred bottles or something, and people line up for miles to buy it?
I remember looking at this guy, these guys once, and some they have a story similar to that. And then, yeah, some of the other, especially the Trappist monasteries of that, but the Trappists are newer in general. I mean, Trappists are successors, like, what, 15th, 16th, 16th century. Wow. So I don't know how that all comes in there, but, yeah, these guys say they're the oldest. Maybe that's the oldest commercial one, oldest distributing one. Who knows?
So for our listeners, you might know Chris from a number of places. He's currently a senior web developer over at the University of Florida.
Go Gators.
Kind of close, right? How far is that from Miami?
Miami, 5 hours.
Okay, yeah, so it's a little ways. Because I almost was a hurricane when I went to college. I had to basically flip a coin between two schools, and I chose the wrong one, as it turns out. So, but he's also where you really might know him from if you are a WordPress user of any kind. Chris, I was about to say help develop, but you developed the Better WP security plugin, didn't you?
Yep, I built that and then eventually sold it to iThemes, where it became iThemes Security.
And you worked over there with them for a year or two a couple years back, right?
Yep, I was with them once I sold it and kind of directed the integration, if you will, of that for about a year and a couple of months before I went to something else.
Cool. It's always really cool seeing that plugin come up like on different themes, like in other people's things.
Yeah, it got definitely a lot bigger than I ever had imagined it would once I started it. That's for darn sure.
I know somebody famous. So that's Chris. We're going to be talking with him here in just a moment about web security. We're going to kind of run through very basics. We're not going to get deep into firewall configurations and, you know, hardcore SQL injections and penetration testing. We just want to talk about how, if you are a web developer, especially a young one getting started or something along those lines, you know, what you should be thinking about and how you just get the very basics going so that you can make sure your stuff is secure. I want to talk first, though, because I got something I got to share. And it's one of the, so, and I say that, and you know what it makes me think about is like the old horror movies where it's like, what, The Ring, you see the videotape and you got to hand the videotape off in 7 days or you die. Yeah,
yes.
That's how I feel at the moment.
Yeah, well, this you shared it with me, and I got to agree. I think this is the right thing to do.
The headline I came across earlier today, and this has nothing to do with web. I just want to talk about it because I feel creepy. The headline was David Lynch made a disturbing web sitcom called Rabbits. It's now used by psychologists to induce a sense of existential crisis in research subjects. And so I was like, I like David Lynch. I have nothing against the man. I enjoy a good, weird, creepy kind of film. And I sat down and watched about 10 minutes of this Rabbits episode/movie. It's kind of unknown what it really is. And all I can say is I don't think I've seen something that weird in about 10 years.
Coming from you, that says an awful lot.
You know, this feels bizarre.
Watching it feels like if you ever like sit in a room and just make eye contact with somebody and say nothing, and then there's this whole like parade of feelings that go through. Like at first it's like, oh, like giggle, like this is fun, weird, like, and then it gets awkward, and then it gets strange, and then it gets this weird place where it just feels, it feels too real. And that's kind of what it felt like watching this.
It feels like Lynch took Donnie Darko and put it in a blender yes. with too many cooks. That's what it feels like.
Yes. Oh my God. Too many cooks. Yes. Yeah, definitely.
The style, it was made about 15 years ago, and I think 2002 is when he recorded this. And he did it when he was doing that recording on like either Digital 8 or something like that. So it's got a very amateur kind of feel to it, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got that kind of style to his filming. All it's got three characters in it. They are anthropomorphized rabbits. People in giant rabbit suits.
Looks like a Barbie playhouse almost that they're in.
One of those rabbits is Naomi Watts.
What? Really?
Yeah.
She's in like a lot of his films though.
So the research they were doing, because I had to know, I had to understand what was going on. These researchers back around 2013 were taking people and they had two groups. And some of them, they said, here, write us a few paragraphs on what you think happens to your body when you die. And then the other group, they had watch rabbits and write about it or something like that. And they gave them Tylenol. They were testing whether or not Tylenol / acetaminophen had the ability to relieve the pain of existential crisis. And they found that it did. So I need people to feel the weird, uncomfortable, whatever this is that I have in me now, which sounds way dirtier than I intended to. Go look up YouTube. It's on YouTube like everything is. David Lynch, rabbits.
Put in the show notes.
And cool. Yeah, no, there's going to be a link in the show notes. Yes. I will embed the YouTube video there if I have to.
Let's also include Too Many Cooks and the Rejected by Don Hertzfeldt.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, but I think those are in the similar vein.
My spoon is too big.
I'm feeling fat and sassy.
So with that, God, now I don't know if I can get through the rest of the show after that.
Keep drinking.
This is by far the best intro I've ever had. There's opening topic to start with security. Then
you don't even have to pay us for it.
we brought you on to save us. What are you talking about? Pull us out of this this downward spiral. Yeah? Nine Inch Nails, David Lynch.
Yeah. Ah.
Oh man, that was a reach. I'm sorry. So to get started today, we mentioned we're going to talk about web security, some basics. I am going to try effort to split us up into two halves. First, I want to talk a little bit about basic like the server level stuff and just the simple tools that are out there and what you can use, and then we'll get a little bit more into like the actual web side of things on application level and stuff like that, help you understand the different types of attacks that are out there and how you protect against those. And Chris, if you think we're gonna get off of here without talking about WordPress a little bit, well, you're wrong. That's gonna happen, but Chris is a great guy to help us along and keep us steered right, I think, is probably the best part about this. So
we're going to bring Chris on, who did WordPress security, and then not talk about WordPress the whole show. We're going to avoid it specifically.
Wait, this isn't a Drupal show?
Yeah, it's only Drupal. We only talk about Drupal.
It makes sense.
It could be, if you want it to be.
Good Lord.
So a lot of folks get started. They don't think about security a lot because the first step that most web developers take is they go out, they hit Bluehost or HostGator or one of these folks for $3.95 a month, the shared host. They probably get a free SSL certificate with it, and that's what they do. And they run along with that idea until the first time some website that they've never heard of gets compromised. And then suddenly every WordPress site on that server that they happen to be sharing is suddenly compromised. And they're trying to figure out what they did wrong. And it was nothing. They didn't do anything wrong. It's just that shared hosting sucks and it's a terrible value for what you get out of it. I might be a little jaded because I might have a history with a couple web hosts that did not have good security.
Last time I was in Aaron's neck of the woods, I was about 2 o'clock in the morning on an Amtrak going through upstate New York, trying to fix a site where a host had taken it down for another site on the box had gotten compromised. So they took the whole box down and just basically told us all too bad.
Wow. Yeah. So the answer to why should you host your own website is, it's more work, but it's way easier to know if something's going wrong, if it's your fault.
I wouldn't even say host your own, but pay for good hosting.
Pay for
good hosting. If you don't know what you're doing, then you're probably worse off than even the shared hosting. But there's so many good hosts out there, managed VPS, managed WordPress hosts, things like that. They're $30-$35 bucks a month. They're not the $3.95 special, but you get what you pay for.
Yeah. And that is a very fair statement that probably bears clarification that we should look at the bulk sort of what do you want to call it, the clearinghouse web hosts, the Walmart web hosts, so to speak,
EIG.
versus like say like a WP Engine or somebody like this, that I mean their business is hosting lots of websites and keeping them very secure and taking that stuff very seriously. A disclaimer, the company I work for, we do use WP Engine. I am thrilled with it. That's not a paid endorsement of any kind or anything like that. It's been great for us. I've had no security problems with it to date. So there is definitely a distinction there. But like I say, yeah, we pay for that advantage. It is not $4 a month. It's, I think they start at like 20 a month or something like that.
30, I think, nowadays.
Is it 30? Yeah, they raised prices recently. So have to sign that check.
The continuum of that is, on the one hand, you have the shared hosting on the cheap side, and then you have the self-hosted where you manage it, and then you have the managed hosting, right? WP Engine?
Yeah. Or you could do the hybrid in something like DigitalOcean, where you go just rent a box, and then for $10 a month, you can, or more, depending on what plan you get, you can pay somebody like ServerPilot to manage that box that you get for you and actually split that up.
Yeah, and I've heard a lot about ServerPilot in the last probably 6 months. I've never used it yet, but it seems really interesting.
A podcast organization I do a lot of work for, I moved them over to ServerPilot, a year ago, and it's been wonderful for them.
Which, for our listeners, ServerPilot is basically I don't want to call it a dashboard, doesn't sound right, like a hypervisor kind of service, right? Isn't that a fair way of putting
it? It's more of a manager. It's more of a bot that goes in and just updates everything for you and makes sure everything's in good shape, handles the backups. So it's not a virtualization thing in and of itself, because you have a full, like, you actually have to go out and rent the real server. They only use, I think they only use DigitalOcean, but then they connect to that server and they install things for you and set it up and get everything secured for you.
And I'm a DigitalOcean user myself, and one of my side companies also uses it for our application infrastructure. Huge fan. And that's where I get into stuff like, if you're paying $4 a month for, you know, a cheap shared host, you have no excuse to not spend $5 a month with a basic DO droplet and take a couple days and just learn how to configure it right.
Yep.
That value is worth its weight in gold, because at the end of the day, going through that process in general is going to make you better. It's going to make you a better developer. It's going to help you understand how shit works.
I was going to say, too, as a developer, you could spin up a $5. Yeah, I use Linode for my boxes just because, they leapfrog. Linode's faster for a year than DigitalOcean will upgrade hardware and it'll be faster. Currently, I'm on Linode because Disk.io has been faster. I could spin up for $5. I can run 20 or 30 dev sites. So any client that I'm working on the side, forget this DNS, Docker, Vagrant, whatever you want to use locally is great. But if you could set it up on a server and actually show the client, then you're not putting production stuff. I don't know. I shy away from telling anybody who doesn't know servers well to put something in production on for a client or anything other than their own stuff. But for dev work, You can learn a whole lot. Sorry, Mike, I'm not trying to back that off, but I do worry about that because I've made that suggestion before and it's blown up in my face.
There are no right answers. There are no wrong answers. I shouldn't say it. No, there are wrong answers with GDPR out there now.
A lot of these, a lot of the configurable servers like DigitalOcean or Linode, the hosts usually have huge knowledge bases with all of you want to install WordPress, you want to install like fail to ban, you want to install like UFW, whatever. And they'll have like these really elaborate how to's that explain exactly how to do it. And so even if you're not comfortable or understand how to do it yourself, if you're feeling adventurous, you can totally kind of go by the recipe. And they're usually pretty reproducible without problems.
And yeah, that brings up a good thing too. If you're going to do it, a combination of fail to ban with UFW slash IP. I mean, UFW is nothing but a way to make IP tables, which is the classic user Linux firewall. It's a way to make it easier. And fail to ban just uses both of them. It just looks at log files. So when somebody tries to get into your box and they get the password wrong a couple of times, it blocks it at the firewall level. So if you're going to play with those services, DigitalOcean, Linode, Vulture, whatever.
And you might be thinking, like, oh, I just have a tiny little blog with maybe like 5 or 10 readers that most of them know me personally. Nobody will ever try to hack my site. And you would be wrong, because you can put up, I had a dev instance put up that was only used by me And within, a day, I had Chinese and Russian IPs hammering at it and trying to break into SSH.
Well, it's not about you. People shouldn't think of themselves as, well, I'm small, so why would I ever be a target?
Right.
It's not about you. It's about when your IP address just comes up in the Rolodex.
Yeah.
That's all it amounts to.
There's robots that are just scanning random numbers on the internet. That's really reductive to say, explain it like that, but that's basically what it is.
Well, just go through internet and see which domains have been registered. See mm-hmm. if there's something vulnerable. If you're on DigitalOcean, hey, now you got another crypto miner. Even if it's the $5, I mean, that's still resources, yeah. right? If you're on shared hosting, hey, look, now you got a couple thousand sites. Maybe you get lucky and you get the guy with 10,000 hits a day, and now you're spamming links out of there.
Well, with the rise of things like the JavaScript crypto miners and stuff, too, you're injecting that into somebody's site or thing and they don't even know it's there, and outside of somebody noticing that their CPU is spiking when they visit your site, that could sit there for months without getting detected if somebody isn't paying attention.
Yeah.
It's definitely something to, you know, to consider. And Aaron, you brought up like the documentation side. I found DigitalOcean's documentation before I actually started using their service.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I started using their service.
Same. Was
because they killed it in the documentation department.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
being able to read through very clear, because that's one thing I always find with a lot of especially like real, you know, server level command prompt level instructions can sometimes get a little gnarly. You know, depending on the person writing it, they may skip something obvious or they won't explain why they're doing a certain step. And I'm big about that. I get really annoyed. It doesn't matter if it's a server thing, a code thing, whatever. When people just spit code out but don't say what it is doing, that annoys me, because I'm trying to learn. I want to know, well, why did you throw this command in there? Because I may not need that later. I may want to build on it or whatever. But DigitalOcean stuff, like they had the right idea, because they kind of came at this with their service, but they really came at it with a robust documentation suite when they launched. And they have been winning the SEO contest out of the gate against even when I'm searching for generic tutorials. Now, I know Google, you know, they bias their search results anyway, but I still regularly point people to DigitalOcean documentation, because it's like, it doesn't matter. If you're using, you know, Ubuntu, you know, 1604 or 1804 or whatever, it's still, the commands work the same. It's, you know, it has nothing to do with where you're hosting at that point. Yeah.
DigitalOcean is by far the best resource probably out there right now for Ubuntu DevOps.
Yeah, definitely. And the nice thing is that since Ubuntu is all like centralized repository package management, I know that like Red Hat has RPM and everything, but like the apt-based system is awesome, because whether you're doing it on your own private server elsewhere or your home desktop or on your DigitalOcean account or on a Linode account running the same version of Ubuntu, the packages are going to be the same.
Yeah.
The configuration will almost certainly be the same. Sometimes like the directories will be mapped slightly differently. And so that's why, like when Michael was talking about the explanations of things, that can be really nice, because it's like, oh, you know, they explain like it's going to be in /opt or whatever. Maybe yours isn't in /opt. It's in /etc or something.
So Chris, you mentioned, I think it was, I think you said it first, fail to ban is obviously one of the first stops you make. Fail to ban basically just watches people trying to log into your server, and you point it at SSH or whatever you've got open. And I think it, you know, you can lock it into HT access stuff or whatever the case may be. And if somebody tries to log in three times and fails, their IP gets put in the IP tables as just a disallow. You don't get in.
Yeah. And there's three levels to this, right? First of all, you have to have IP tables as a firewall. It's just above the kernel level. So if an IP is blocked at this, they're not even touching your PHP. They're not executing scripts. They're not getting to your Apache, Nginx, whatever. Okay, so you want that. It's going to save resources as you block somebody. You know, and Ubuntu, you turn UFW on, you allow 80 and 443 and your SSH port, which should probably be set to something over 2000. And then there's only three ports that even have access to your machine. Then you turn around and install fail to ban. Fail to ban just looks at your logs, and you set it. You set these things, they call them jails, and you set these filters, and you tell it to, hey, look at SSH logs, and any, you know, look for X amount of attempts in there. You can have hard bands and soft bands and all this and that, where it just blocks things. There's WordPress plugins, Drupal modules, and all this and that that'll write back to your Apache logs, Nginx logs, whatever. Say every time somebody logs in with the wrong WordPress account. So then it blocks them at the firewall level, and they're not even messing with your machine. They're not racing your resources, et cetera. I mean, it really can cut down a load quite a bit.
And with Fail2Ban in particular, those jails, it comes with, if my memory is right, because it's been a long time since I've even logged into mine. The jails, you know, it's got several of them that are pre-configured for things like Apache and Nginx, that it just, it knows how to look at those logs. As long as you just say, here's where they are.
Yeah, just most of them aren't turned on, though. I mean, when you install Fail2Ban, even if you say enable Fail2Ban service, none of the jails are active. You still have to make sure you turn. I have to put that disclaimer. That's another one of the disclaimers I've seen the hard way when I've suggested it to people. They come back 6 months later. I've never seen any of these emails. You go, I'll take a look at your server. Oh, sorry. I guess I forgot that step where you have to manually specify.
Chris, you had mentioned changing your SSH port to something in the 2000s. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that point?
Oh, sure. Historically, I mean, most services we use, anything on TCP or anything using an IP address comes in on a port, right? 80 for HTTP, 443, 1025 is SMTP. MySQL is 3306. And they all had these standard ports, most of which historically were under the number 2000. So most scanners historically, and I got to be honest, I don't know if it's still true where the scanners really start looking, but a lot of the nmaps and a lot of the normal scanning that's done, just looking for open ports on a machine, just scans 1 through 2000 because there's a whole host of services that can be exploitable if they're there in that range. So one of the first things I typically do is switch, take any SSH port I'm using and up it well over, to a really high port number that I know is unlikely to be around another service. Mm-hmm.
And that's ICANN's fault, for anybody who cares to be interested. they are the ones who aside, and I mean, I say fault, well, you know, it has to be done, but they're the ones who have kind of set up that standard of here are your registered ports, you know, whether that's, 80, 443, 25, any of these 20, 22, those have all been assigned by them so that all the machines knew how to talk to each other, basically. Mm-hmm. And then anything over, I think it runs up to 1024 or something like that are the ones that they've registered. And anything over that is then just fair game, I guess.
Historically, And of course, this has changed now, right? Memcached is 11.211. MySQL is 3306. There are others up there, but I still if I look through logs, I see very little scanning going on in anything over 2000 still.
Yeah, if someone's going to be scanning, if they have, a blanket list of IP or just like a mask of IPs they're going to be scanning, and they're going to be scanning a whole bunch of ports, it's a multiplicatively increasing thing. You have 2,000 ports across, say, 4,000 IP addresses. That's, 8 million, right? 8 million different scans?
Yes. I can do that.
I finished my beer. I can't do that anymore.
So that's 8 million different port scans that they have to do. And so they could just say that set their nmap to scan above 2000, but if you are in a crowd of other possible IP addresses, they're probably not going to do that because they'll probably find someone else who does have something open lower than 2000. It's like that whole thing, I don't have to be faster than the tiger. I just have to be faster than you.
There's a lot of truth to that. I'd be curious. I'd love to talk. I have to ask Tony Perez from Security next time I see him if that's still the number, the cutoff number, if that's still a significant thing, because the way attacks have evolved over the years. But that's always been
If you're high value target, they're going to do a full band scan. They're going to be a lot more targeted and thorough. But if they're just doing casting a broad net.
So the key there is if you go in and reassigning port numbers and stuff is beyond the scope of what I think we care to tell you about. If you want to know how, Google it, you'll find a tutorial on how you change your ports for services. But if you want to do that, the other thing that dovetails in with that is using UFW. And you can straight up say, not only am I, going to have SSH on port, 7,021, if you aren't from my IP address, mm-hmm. you also just can't get to it. Now, the tricky thing about that is, A, of course, you have to know your IP address, and B, hope your IP address never changes.
Yeah, that's kind of a big caveat. And I think you can specify like a range of IP addresses.
Yeah, you can give ranges if you're familiar with how, especially like if your ISP, you know, of course, is going to have a block. So you could narrow it down to say, yeah, I'm not going to allow only my IP, but I'm going to trust that probably the other, you know, 256 on this range won't, or, you know, you can go up a couple octets on that. So
just pay for if you know you have to do that, spend the $3 a month on one of these VPNs that gives you a static IP.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of folks, like if you're doing it for work, your work is going to have, that's like most companies, that's how they do it is, you know, when they've got their VPN set up, it's set. It has an internal IP at that point. And because all your servers are behind the firewall,
exactly, that's
all they let in. So even if you were on the network, you know, without being on the VPN, you couldn't get to their servers. At least for us, I know that's how we work. So
on the off chance that you do, like let's say that you set that up and then either you lose the VPN configuration or you forget what port you picked because you had it saved in your laptop and you just re-imaged it or something. Most hosts will have a web-based console that you can log in through, which is kind of like a little virtual console. I think it's a Java app. DigitalOcean has it.
It's not good.
It's terrible, but
it's good enough to get you around that.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. If you're locked out, you can get in through that and you can check your SSH settings and like set them to something more open so that you can then reconfigure it.
For Mac, just use Terminal. For Windows, I use PuTTY. I like it. It works PuTTY's well. Good.
Yeah.
So let's talk about SSH just a hair more, though, because that's and if you don't know, SSH is how you talk to a headless server. You know, you work with your desktop all day. If you're somebody who spends all day in Photoshop and all that, you know, you're used to the whole GUI interface. When you work on a server, that's still pretty much all text because it's happening remotely. And that's just the most efficient way to get data back and forth and do it with low latency. Secure. SSH is the secure connection that makes that possible. And so when you set that up, that's, you know, when you type in your IP address, whether it's in the terminal, in the PuTTY, whatever, and it comes up and it says, you know, who's logging in, and you type in root, and what's your password, and you type in root, you're in for trouble.
Don't set your password to root.
Just warning you. So the reason I say that is, you can configure SSH, and again, there are, well, and I promise, I'm going to go through and look up specific tutorials on the stuff we're talking about. I'll make sure we leave links in the show notes. You can lock down SSH to only allow keys, which is a good way to prevent just, you know, brute force password attacks. Mm-hmm. So if somebody is just trying to open up your SSH port and feed it a username and password, it won't even get the opportunity. It'll just be turned away right then and there. If you don't know how that works, learn.
Yeah, that's actually, I would say that when we're talking about the trinity of web development with HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, this is like part of the core things for doing DevOps is learn how SSH keys work because you're going to use them all the time.
Yeah. I'm a big fan. I don't know what you guys use, but LastPass I use for storing keys now. Mm-hmm. Since I move between, I've got three different machines, four counting my phone, five counting my tablet, that I need to use keys on. And LastPass is like all hail because that keeps my keys organized. And again, mm-hmm. not a paid plug of any kind. I just use it and I like it. And it helps keep that. Cause the thing is you store when you generate a key pair, you're going to get a private key and a public key. You put your public key everywhere that needs to know who you are. And then you send the private key when you log in, and it does a handshake that, without getting into how that happens, it's like mixing paint, so to speak, to figure out if the colors are what they are supposed to be without necessarily divulging what the starter colors were. It knows it's supposed to end up with green, basically. That's similar to the way SSL handshakes work. But you store those, but you need to keep that private key needs to stay with you on a thumb drive in LastPass somewhere encrypted wherever, because if you lose that private key, you lose your ability to log in, and you better hope that you have a means of getting back into it. It's
scary. You be key for the win.
I'm gonna ask this question because Chris, I value your opinion greatly, which is why you're here. So you're welcome. Scotch isn't too bad, mind you. I've had this conversation a few times with folks, and the answers I get are always interesting and never consistent. You know, we talk about and we impress upon people the process of using different passwords for all their services. Don't use one password, because if you use one password and one service gets compromised, all of them get compromised. And yet we encourage people to use key pairs. And I feel like that isn't better.
It is and it isn't, because remember, you know, a password is symmetrical. And the big difference between not having 1,000 key pairs is they're asymmetrical, right? Let's back up here, probably to give some background. You mentioned keys a lot. A key in this case is we're talking about basically two sides of a password. You have one half that you have, one half that the server has, and they only work in that combination. So you can use your password on anything, but unless it has that other exact matching copy, it's never going to work. And they're not interchangeable, so on and so forth. That asymmetrical difference, for all practical purposes, means you probably don't know. I mean, I'm paranoid. I have a separate key pair for pretty much every server I log into. It kind of goes with my nature. I'm actually looking at moving into GPG for a lot of us. There's a gentleman by the name of Eric Mann, one of the people I respect most in this business. He works for a company called Tosny. But he keeps doing a lot of tutorials and moving these all to YubiKeys. And now that I finally have a laptop or working USB ports, I can actually use these things, which are hardware keys. I'll store these. But then I'll basically be using one or two keys for most of my servers. And the more I read on this, that asymmetrical nature, really, there's not a whole lot of downside to it from a practical point of view.
That's a way better metaphor than my paint one. So I'm gonna steal that for the future.
Just to clarify, a YubiKey is a USB dongle you plug in. It has a little button on it, and then it generates a super long string of alphanumeric characters.
Well, which is basically it generates one of these keys in most cases, or it can be used with a two-factor. Like, you know, when your bank sends you the six-digit code, it can generate those codes.
Right.
But you can program them. I'll have to send you guys the links for the show notes on this. But Eric's had a great tutorial on using it to replace SSH keys, which has a lot of benefits if handled right. They expire. Mm-hmm. Or if you're doing it right, then what you do is you set an expiration date on your YubiKey or whatever. So it expires after, you know, a year or whatever, a year, 2 years, whatever is reasonable for what your threat model is. And then you're only using one key, that if you ever lose it, the worst case is you still have your backdoors into your servers. You know, that's the case with everything. You're changing, you lose your LastPass account, you got to change your 1,000 servers. So there's always that one point of failure, the way we're practically keeping track of these keys these days. But having a YubiKey and using GPG, well, PGP for this type of authentication has a lot of benefits, and simply that they expire.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's neat. I'll have to look. I have not heard of the YubiKey. Now, I've heard of some similar stuff, but that's I didn't know you could use it at like the SSH level. That's super cool.
I'll send you guys the link. Link to a really neat tutorial on that after this that you could play with it. It's kind of fun to mess with.
Yeah, so awesome.
A few months back, there was that Equifax hack, and I remember in the aftermath of that, there was a lot of chatter in the security circles about things you should do immediately in case your social was part of the breach. And one of the things was your IRS and Social Security, like the .gov, they were recommending that you set up an account on both of them and enable two-factor authentication so that it requires every time you want to log in, it sends you a text message. You're probably not logging into it very often. But it's a pain in the butt, and it sucks that we would even have to do things like that. But it's better than, you know, having your data compromised.
Well, you know, I used 1Password, an alternative to LastPass, and I keep a vault that I don't let download on my computers for things like that, like Social Security and IRS and all that stuff. Because, you know, we're talking about authentication. Well, think about it. Your Social Security number in those cases are both authentication and identification.
Whoops. What will be interesting there is the new system that Google and Facebook are working on. We talked about it on a real-time overview episode, and now the name is flittering out of my head. But they're working on a new biometric two-factor.
Huh. I've seen it. I actually just use my YubiKey for both Facebook and, well, when I have to log, I try to avoid logging into Facebook, period, anymore. But for Google and Facebook and GitHub, all of them take YubiKey. So I just use those. Nice.
That's cool. Thanks. Yeah, definitely. Well, I will enjoy sharing that with our listeners. That sounds awesome. With SSH, the other side of this is when you set everything up, the first thing that happens is a root account gets made. And this is where every hacker movie ever has, you know, talked about how you get root and now you've got everything. And there's a reason for that, because you get root, you get everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, it gets generated because something has to get generated and you need to know what it is. But one of the first things that any tutorial will tell you to do is to get rid of that root account, lock it down. You can't get rid of it, but you can make it inaccessible to anything outside of the box.
You can make it where it's not even allowed to log in. You can't log in as root, period.
You can't log in. You can't do anything that except inside using the S, what they call the SU command, the super user command.
Change the name of it, for the love of God.
Change the name of it is always an option. And set up a separate account. That's your name. That's anything else. And authorize it on sudo or whatever you want to use there so that it can execute the commands you want. But it then is sandboxed. Everything is logged within the servers automatically, usually on that. So if somebody does compromise that account, there should be a trail, depending on how good your hacker is. But, you know, most people, I think, people don't understand, and I use the phrase, Chris, that I'll bring back up, the threat models that come into play here. Folks think about hacking as this thing where a person sits behind a computer and is typing stuff into a machine and making another machine do something. Most 99% of hacking is automated. It's one machine just running a test against another machine, and if it passes, then it runs other tests until it stores something and then it leaves. Like, almost no hacking involves a human being at this point, because it's just not scalable.
I would contest that only on that social engineering is still a huge part of, like, the process of, like, security compromise.
Targeted attacks in general. A targeted attack is often human directed. It's everything else that's different.
That's very one-to-one, and people don't scale. Human beings have no ability to scale. So it's like one person is going to attack a machine, whereas another machine can attack tens of thousands of machines in that same amount of time.
And, you know, you said that right. I said rename root, but no, I mean, the correct answer is don't allow root to log in. Use a separate account. So I've been doing it for so long, I sometimes think of that as my root account when I name my other accounts. But I mean, that's part. Yeah. Any common denominator, it's horrible, because it almost sounds like, and I get, in a lot of ways it is, it's security by obscurity, right? You're hiding something. But there's sometimes reasons to use that, and on the very most basic level.
Dave Kennedy, he's a big name in the InfoSec community. He was the keynote at AnyCon last year out in Albany. I was fortunate enough to see that. And he was saying that 95% of the compromises, and he didn't qualify this statistic, but most of this compromise that happened are unsigned executable downloaded from the internet. So, like, stuff like malicious code that's been injected into something that you execute after downloading it. So if you're a sysadmin, and this is kind of out of scope for this talk, but if you're a sysadmin, like, don't allow your users to run unsigned executables from the internet. And that's like the most of your things right there.
We can't even use USB drives on our machines at work.
Huh.
Now, that's because, like, we have, like, federal level security stuff that we have to comply with as a company because of some of our clients. But yeah, like, our machines are hard locked down.
Which is funny because the ones I have at work, they have lockdown software, but then they don't allow up like security updates and various things on the Mac. So I want to do a lot of my work with my personal machine because A, I can access things, but B, it's actually more secure than the work machine they give me.
My machine got reported back to our IT staff because I was running, I think it was XAMPP or something like that, just an Apache server because I'm a web developer. I need a local dev environment sometimes, but because it was not an approved executable.
Our VPN, when I have to do VPN, you know, when I, everything's accessible for VPN, it's, and I, of course I work remotely, I'm 3 hours from campus. And every time I look, Stack Overflow is always flagged as adult content. the list goes on and on and on.
So that's a little bit about SSH anyway. There's a whole lot more to it. There's a lot that goes into that, but that is because that is the front door of your server for most things. It's important to learn it and understand it a little bit. And I say, we'll include some extra resources there. The last thing I want to touch on before I need to go refill my glass and get some more ice because I need some water mixed in with this. It may not be the greatest scotch, but it does the job, let me tell you. SSL. Now, even though SSL is, it kind of, actually it's the perfect transition element because it's server related, but it's also, you know, web app related and things like that. One of the draws to shared hosting oftentimes is that they offer like a free, you know, free SSL certificate. Because they've just wildcarded it to their root machine or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's great because it used to be getting a signed SSL certificate.
It was expensive.
Yeah. It was hard to do. It was not a user-friendly process.
You need to go like VeriSign or something, right?
VeriSign, Komodo, any of these folks. Yeah. You go in, you know, you have to put in server information, your information, you get these files. You're like, I don't know where do I put these files? How do I link them to stuff?
You definitely put them in the wrong order and everything blows up.
Right. And SSL for anybody who, again, this is, I know we have some listeners who are getting into this stuff. The SSL is the thing that makes the HTTPS green on Chrome. When you see the word secure up there, SSL is the thing that helps cloak the information that you are sending to the website so that when you send a handshake to that site, it knows who you are, you know who it is, it knows that you're both the same people, and it locks everything down within that tunnel. So in theory,
right,
your stuff is relatively cloaked. Now, that doesn't mean your ISP can't tell what you're, you know, getting at or what type of data you're getting. Maybe not the contents of the data, but they can tell the types. And you know, because packet shaping and stuff comes into play there, but it helps ensure that because when you make a form submission, let's say a basic contact form, something super simple, and you click that send button, if there's anything in that transmission circuit, whether that's malicious or it's just a router with really aggressive logging, your stuff gets logged in plain text. If you have SSL. It's just a payload at that point.
Yeah.
And all they can see is that data got sent, but the data itself is obscured that way. So it's not just about like a hacker. It's just about somebody seeing something that you don't want them to see. You know, you don't want your bank account balance being seen by a third party router somewhere out in the middle of your connection.
Specifically these days it's you're sitting in Starbucks. You don't want three or four years ago, there was a Firefox extension called FireSheep. And this is what really started the big SSL certificate when Facebook's Twitter and everybody started enforcing it. It was a Firefox extension I could install. They'll give me a sidebar. And if I was on an open Wi-Fi, you know, Wi-Fi, I didn't have to put a password in. It would pop up with everybody around me, you know, somebody with the Facebook, it would pop up with Facebook. I click on it. Now I'm them on Facebook. SSL is the one that blocks all that from happening. It wraps everything between my user and me and my server.
So if you're accessing a website over regular HTTP, like, so not with not SSL, you can go on Amazon, you can get an external network adapter with Wi-Fi. I have one, it's an alpha. I forget the exact model number. But you can put it in promiscuous mode, which means you can just sniff all the traffic that's flying around you through the air like in the Willy Wonka movie. And you can just listen to that, and you can see stuff come through in plain text. If it's going over SSL, then it's encrypted and you can't just view it. But if it's not, you can, you know, grab the images right out of the air. You can grab, you know, usernames, passwords, whatever else, right out of the air.
You guys both probably played with Wireshark at some point, right?
Yep. Yeah.
I was going to say a pineapple too is
yeah.
The in some ways a classic for the script kiddies, if you will.
So SSL is important. And now there's also been a lot of, you know, talk in the last, 2 years about how now Google is, you know, factoring SSL into PageRank and, you know, the notification in Chrome, in Firefox, noting whether or not a site is secure, and now how they are aggressively noting unsecure sites. It used to be like if your site was not using SSL, it just didn't do anything. It showed secure, but it didn't do anything if it was unsecure. Now they're flagging it as not secure. So SSL has a lot of benefits, even if you're just low level, if you're using user data, and I'm going to invoke the phrase and then take a drink, but if you've got anything GDPR related at all, if you take an email, a name, you have a reason to have at least a little bit of cloak wrapped around that pipeline.
Even before that, I mean, just your user's privacy. If you have a one-page web app, I mean, most coffee shop, if I wanted to know who's applying to what job, sit in a local coffee shop in a small town, and it'd be easy to pull all that data right out.
If you're
protecting your user's privacy.
If your users are submitting anything at all other than requesting content from your site, like, you should probably be doing SSL with like let's encrypt.
Mm-hmm. And so boom, magic words, because that is what has changed the game for SSL. And I know there are a lot of people who have a lot of bad things to say about Let's Encrypt, and they have valid complaints about, you know, the way people are, you know, able to scam it, you know, since it's all automated, whatever. Mm-hmm. But for all of its failings, it also is granting a huge advantage to people running legitimate sites and needing to have that secure layer.
You know, Let's Encrypt's magic is two things. One, it's a free certificate, but that's the easy part. CertBot is really the magic of Let's Encrypt.
Yeah.
The certificate itself is trivial.
Yeah.
A certificate's a certificate. 4096-bit encryption is 4096-bit encryption, regardless if it's Komodo or who. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's a green star, shows your name certificate. The encryption's the same. It's that CertBot where you can just go out and literally CertBot, or let's, you know, I go to my server, CertBot renew. Everything's taken care of.
Done. It's so nice.
It has taken what used to take half an hour, an hour of work, and distilled it down to like four commands.
So like imagine what you might think as a listener that a crappy car is. Just imagine a crappy car, whatever that may be. I'm not going to name a make and model here. Whatever you think of a crappy car, that's Let's Encrypt.
Kia Soul.
Sure. So you're a hamster and you need a car. Get a Kia Soul, right? It's not a Cadillac. It's not a Ferrari. It's not the best, but it gets you to where you're going. And that's.
But how is it not the best? I mean, what difference does paying for a certificate make?
Because the things Michael was mentioning earlier, because you don't have the third party involvement from like a VeriSign or a trusted third party.
But VeriSign, there's
not a cert, you know, that's Let's Encrypt is the cert authority that VeriSign is. So for the cheap, the $9, $10 a year, whatever it is, VeriSign, I think they're $9.95 if you look at GoDaddy and most of them. That is literally the same certificate, which is a different signer as Let's Encrypt. The difference is entirely in the technology of how it's delivered.
Yeah.
That's why I say CertBot's such the magic key. And that's where a lot of people don't like it. CertBot makes it too easy. There's no knowledge required at all. Let's Encrypt, install, get cert. You know, you don't have to go online and type, but you still have to type in your name, your email address, and the basics to get the cert. But there's no verification on a normal cert. It's only when you go to a bank and you see the name of a cert in there. There's different trust levels, but those are $200, $300 certificates. And if you need that verification, You're still thinking.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what I was talking about, just maybe not using the right words.
Let's not forget, though, the irony of this part of the discussion, because wasn't it Trustico a few months back that had like 23,000 SSL certs compromised, and DigiCert was just like, listen, we can't trust any of these certificates anymore, and Trustico won't answer our emails, so we're just posting all the private keys now, so they have no choice. Yes. So the idea that paying for a certificate makes it better is just patently false. It's, you know, it's a belief, but there is just nothing that makes that true.
And well, when you do pay, well, that's not entirely true, because when you're talking about verification, you're talking about, you want to verify, it's, encryption is one thing, verification is another. If you want to pay $300 to be verified, that's different. Now you're sending incorporation documents, driver's license photos, all kinds of verification documents back to the signer, VeriSign, Komodo. Let's Encrypt doesn't even offer that level of verification. Mm-hmm. You have to send that to one of those services and come back. And then you're, you know, then you don't just get the secure in Chrome, but it actually tells you the name in green letters next to it, right? But that's a whole level, different level. Same certificate still, but the verification on the certificate is a different level.
Yeah, and that's, if that's what you need, you don't need to listen to our episode probably.
Probably should go, yeah.
I tell you what, I need to get some more ice. So guys, let's take about 40, 45 seconds here. We'll come back afterwards and we'll start talking a little bit about the website of the security stuff. And yeah, let's do that.
Brilliant.
Sounds good.
Yep.
The Drunken UX podcast is brought to you by our friends at NewCloud. Are you trying to build a case around an interactive map for your school, city, or business? NewCloud's interactive map platform gives you the power to make and edit a custom interactive map in just minutes. Their team of professional cartographers specialize in map illustrations and are ready to design a rendering to fit your exact needs. One map serves all your users' devices, with responsive maps that scale and blend in seamlessly with your website. Visit them online to request a demo at nucloud.com/drunkenux. That's nucloud.com/drunkenux.
So I guess my end result here, or my decision, is that, okay, Speyburn 10, not a great scotch, not terrible. I've had worse. I've had much worse. It's not entirely bad. It's not a bad scotch.
It's the Kia Soul of scotch.
The Kia Soul of scotch. And it does get the job done. So let's see how many more mistakes I can make before the night's up. So continuing the discussion. So we talked a little bit about servers and just kind of what you should be thinking about. And let's be honest. We basically gave you a lot of stuff to go Google later, hopefully. And we'll have links to a lot of those in the show notes as well. So maybe we can save you that much. But a lot of it is going to require you to go out, read some stuff, look at some commands, and understand how these things work. That's cool. We're going to do more of that now, but we're going to talk more about the web application layer. So once you get into Apache and you are making a website, what has to happen there above the server, so to speak, in the atmosphere of the server to keep your stuff secure? And this is where, again, take a drink. If you do anything that involves something that may be impacted by GDPR, there's a huge amount of emphasis on that part of security, because if... And all the stuff we talked about in the first half of the show, all of that is about preventing a breach to begin with. Because if you are compromised under GDPR, if that applies to you, you've got 72 hours to disclose that breach. Ideally, we want to prevent that event from ever happening. The server is one layer, but then the application is another layer. So that's what we're going to look at. And the most basic intrinsic type of attack is sort of this injection, and you know, we can argue too over whether injection or cross-site scripting is sort of more basic, but I put injection as the first bullet point in my notes, so that's
all the injection. Really, cross-site scripting is a type of injection, right? I mean, in all practical purposes,
won't argue that
you're what Michael's talking with injection would be like URL injection. If you've ever looked at a URL, it'll have like a question mark sometimes, and then it'll have like a word and then an equal sign and then some other words or numbers. It's doing stuff where you're messing with the stuff after the question mark, and there's different techniques that you can do.
Well, it's not even, it might be that, it might be a form, you know, putting the right kind of commands in forms. I mean, let's back up a little bit. I mean, if we're going to talk about application security, we probably should give a shout out to OWASP and the OWASP top 10. Mm-hmm. The OWASP is the Open Web Application Security Project. And every 3 years, it was four for the last one, they come up with the 10 most prominent vulnerabilities in web application security. Things like injection, XSS, CSRF, security misconfiguration. You guys will have the link. I think it's already in the show note doc that you gave me before this. I threw the link for that in there. But so as we're talking about, you know, there's a couple that Mike's already mentioned, but they're really all coming out of this OWASP top 10 is the biggest things to worry about. Mm-hmm. And the real watch there is trying to keep somebody from running code that isn't supposed to be running, which at its heart is really an injection. The whole point of an injection is not running code that you didn't intend to. Historically, when we talk injection, that means not running it within the server. There's the old XKCD drop tables cartoon, right?
I mean, I feel like somebody I saw recently had something like that as a username.
Oh, yeah. My
Twitter username is drop table users. Or no, it's dash dash drop table users.
Yeah, Aaron's Twitter name is a attempted injection attack. So apparently Twitter's watched out for that.
Yeah. And I do think that note was this idea of trying to push data into something that shouldn't be there. So whether that's a form, a URL, some kind of input, because websites, whether it's a search form, a login form, a data submission form, a help ticket form, a contact form, they take in information. And I mentioned earlier that, you know, most hacking is by a computer, and while injection testing can absolutely be automated, a lot of that does come at the human level too, of somebody just trying to see, I want to see if I can get into their site. And they feed in to these kinds of commands there's a site, and now I don't remember the name off the top of my head, that lists like, and it's a top 10 kind of list, like what OWASP does, but it lists them as like database commands that people will try to put into form fields because they are trying to see if when that, whatever that form sends to, if it'll hit that string and do something weird.
Yeah. And also what you're talking about too is a type of injection called remote execution vulnerability. Really, in other words, you're trying to run code, you're trying to get the server to run code. You're trying to get the host or the server that has the website on to run code as an injection, right? Drop tables in the database. In other words, delete all your database tape, whatever it might be. But then it's one of those distinctions I've been corrected. Tony Perez from Security, every time I give this talk, I've given about half a dozen times basically a quick breakdown for WordPress developers on the OWASP top 10. And every time he sees it, he goes, you know, XSS is an injection or this is an injection. I'm like, I know, but I'm trying to differentiate between a crowd that doesn't, you know. So shout out to Tony there that I'm finally taking his advice tonight. But no, in all seriousness, though, I mean, that is what we're trying to prevent. We're trying to, by injection, we're simply running code that we didn't want run.
So it's embarrassing, but it happened long enough that I can laugh about it. One of the first web applications I ever made was a rudimentary content management system. This is like shortly before WordPress came out, or like right around when WordPress 1.0 was out maybe. So it was a really long time ago. And there was a basic, you know, login system. It was using MySQL in the back end, PHP in the front end. Anyways, one of my friends worked in a different IT department within the same organization. And after I left, he's like, hey, did you know you had an SQL injection vulnerability on your app? And I was like, what do you mean? And apparently, if you put in the username field, dash dash, or no, if you did or 1=1 semicolon, and then that was it, then it would log you in as the first user, which happened to be the admin user.
That is an old school trick too.
Yeah, that was embarrassing. But in my defense, it was my first web app, and
yeah.
So I can send you my old code. That's just as bad. I get that.
Sure, I'm using code somewhere that probably has some kind of thing just like that. And this is where, like, to prevent those kinds of injection things, whatever language is your language of choice. If you are a database programmer, learn, you know, the what is it, MySQL Real Escape String. If you're a PHP developer, it's, I think, FilterVar. JavaScript just has an escape function. All of these languages come with a function built in that is designed to escape characters. And by escaping the characters, it means that when it gets to whatever processor you're using, whatever system is going through that code, it will treat it like a string character as opposed to a code character. I'm probably using the wrong definitions for those words, but
sanitize early, escape late. If you're a WordPress developer, or if you work in WordPress, WordPress has its whole library of its own for both escaping and sanitization. And if you install the WordPress coding standards in your editor or IDE, it'll tell you right on the line, hey, you've got a CSRF vulnerability right here. You've got an XSS vulnerability right here. And it'll tell you, hey, you didn't escape this line.
GIGO, garbage in, garbage out.
Garbage out. Yep.
if you're taking anything without paying attention to what it is, that's a problem. And it's an easy, you know, it's one of those things. It's like, it's not something I want to slap somebody on the wrist for necessarily. That's an easy mistake to make if you just don't know. You know, and like with Aaron, you know, the first thing you write, it's easy to make those mistakes and not think about how, if that variable drops into code, what does that mean? Especially if it's deep, you know, a function calls a function calls a function, and you're just not thinking about, well, that double quote is going to actually get interpreted and then terminate a command early. Because what this gets to, and Chris, like you were saying, you know, somebody puts it in to try to make the server execute code. What they're really looking for is for the server to do something that isn't expected, whether that's spit out HTML into a page that it shouldn't do, or make a JavaScript alert pop up on the page. When if I do a search should not pop up a JavaScript alert, but if I search for, you know, script alert one, and it does it, then I know, oh, the server is doing something there where it's treating that like actual code.
And then you got an XSS vulnerability if it's running back in the browser, right?
Right.
Then XSS, for all practical purposes, cross-site scripting, and for all practical purposes, it's running code that you didn't want to on the client. You're causing the browser to run code.
Then we get into a type 2 reflective attack.
My favorite story with that is WordPress. I think it was 4.4. The WordPress that allowed emojis and comments, right?
Oh.
Do either of you know why they allow emojis and WordPress comments?
I do not.
Why WordPress used to use UTF-8. And UTF-8 has issues in MySQL where you can basically cut off, you put in the right command, it'll cut it off, and then it'll continue it in the next comment. And that could be exploited. I don't remember all the technicals of it. There's a Loop conference video from NASEN that explains for an hour and a half why it took them a year and a half to patch this vulnerability, which in the end was switching the type of collation used in the WordPress database tables. And as a side effect, it allowed emojis. So they had this big, huge WordPress release that allowed emojis, which the reality was you could leave half of a comment with one half of the command, the other half of the comment with the other half of the JavaScript. Now your linters aren't going to catch it. Your sanitization might not catch it that way. Spits back out. It all gets spun back together. And, oh, shit, now you got a good XSS attack.
That's evil.
That's awesome.
I have to give credit to the people that figure out that kind of stuff. I mean, that takes a special mind.
That took some of the smartest guys at WordPress, Pento, NASEN, and those guys. I think it was about a year and a half to find a good way to, you know, it's not just patching it. It's patching it so you don't break half the freaking internet, right?
Yeah. Right. So that's a good segue from injection to XSS. So there are, I say two, but I guess they're OWASP in particular, I think I recognizes three XSS attacks, type one, type two, and what they call a type zero, which that's the one, like, I don't get the type zero entirely, but we'll see if we can hash it out here in the next few minutes. So type one is the persistent attack. It's doing something. So like a comment, if I enter a comment on your website, they get stored in the database. And then every time somebody visits that page, it loads the information from the website's database that then runs some kind of code. So every time it happens, the user has to do nothing. They just visit the page and they get attacked. Reflective is when you put something in a URL. So you figure out, well, the search box is executing code. So if I send somebody a link that says query equals script, do a bunch of stuff, and I run it through bit.ly, this was, you know, the reason why people would get emails, spam emails with lots of bit.ly links, it's because they were hiding reflective attacks inside those links. So you click it, you end up on the site, and the site looks, you know, either normal, maybe it doesn't look normal, maybe it looks like PayPal, maybe it looks like anything. And then this type zero is what they're calling a DOM attack, which executes a command at the, and Chris, it sounds like you understand what I'm getting at here, so correct me here if I'm wrong, but it executes code at the server level in the DOM, but then removes it before it gets to the client side.
What?
I don't think it always has to remove it. A DOM attack is you're modifying the DOM, so the attack's going to be spit out. So in other words, it's, you know, reflected is typically targeting an error page, right? Or a search page or something that's stateless.
Yeah.
There's no state. You're not carrying it forward from page to page. A DOM attack is typically targeting a standard page, but it's modifying something within there to display it.
The challenge to me with this is understanding the difference between a DOM attack and a persistent attack.
And yeah. I'll be honest, it's been a few years since I was targeting that stuff. I don't worry about it in those terms. I worry about the difference between reflected and persistent, because obviously if you're persistent, you need to look at your database and clean that shit out. Pardon my French.
Yeah.
But
I had, and literally, what, yesterday?
Chris, why would you curse on our show?
Damn it. Now I have to mark the episode explicit. Thanks a lot. Man, now nobody's going to listen. No, I had one of my Twitter followers, Brendan, who I won't call out your last name just in case, but Brendan sent me a tweet and said, dude, I was looking up one of your Tag Manager articles and this came up, and sent me a screenshot, and there was a big old butt, right? Like, it was one of those ad, you know, deals, but like the very first article just had a big old butt in a thong, and it was a WPVCD malware. And I went back and looked, because it wasn't, I knew, like, my blog, and so here you go to the internet. My blog is running an older theme that hasn't been updated in ages. And I thought, well, maybe it's time to change. But I got looking, I'm like, no, it's not my theme. It turned out I had set up a site, just a little compartmentalized site, a couple years ago for a conference that I was giving a presentation at. And so I made up a sandbox site and forgot about it. But that site had an exploit in the theme, and because it was running on the same server. So remember what we were saying about shared hosting earlier, you compromise one theme because they're all at their own directory, but they're all on the same level, running at the same permission level. They were able to then execute code that injected information into my site's theme so that anybody who visited it got fed this other information. So that was a persistent attack at that point. So when they were loading JavaScript at my level because it was stored in my files.
And that's the way typically with WordPress and a lot of the modern content management systems, they're doing it. You know, we say persistent as if it's stored in the database. It's very rare that I've cleaned a site where it's something's stored in post content or something in the database. It's stored throughout. I've gone in sites where there are thousands of files, each with the same.
Yeah. I don't distinguish between stored in a database and stored in a file at that point.
Yeah, I only do it for the sake of
folks. Easier to clean if it's on the file system.
Yeah.
Yeah. If when I was at IU, we had our first pass at doing student blogs. We had a compromise happen, and it went for probably a few weeks without us noticing it, because it was so cleverly targeted. It would use IE conditionals to target specifically, I think, IE5, maybe IE6. And me and the other developer, we only developed in Firefox, so it never came up for us. And it didn't come up for most of my coworkers who all were using the most recent version of IE, which I think was 7 at the time. But we got a couple emails from someone who was using a very old version of IE, and it came up for them. And it was, I forget what it showed, but it was a bunch of spam links or something. Yeah.
So I would be remiss, though, in talking about all of this without talking about WordPress for a minute. So we've got Chris here. He is the grandfather of WordPress security. Let me fluff his ego a little bit.
I'm not sure there's fluff. My ego's calling me old. I don't know.
That could also be true. Maybe I have something against you. You don't know.
I got 3 more weeks for the fifth decade, so give me a break here.
Well, isn't WordPress celebrating its like 15th anniversary this week?
Yeah, right? In fact, you know, I got the shirt going and everything.
Oh, yeah, you do. Oh, I want that shirt. I need to find one of them.
You can buy it off their website.
I don't want to buy it. I want somebody to give it to me. I'm cheap. I run a podcast out of my wallet. I can't buy shirts. So and the reason I think this is a super valuable topic is because what you built addresses a lot of those real sort of high level application level things that you should think about doing. Things like changing the default admin password. We talked about this with SSH and root, and the same is true for WordPress. You install WordPress, you install Drupal, you install Joomla, you install Typo3. Do people still use Typo3? I don't know. But all of these systems, you know, they install an admin user to get you started, but then there's an admin user that has user ID 1, which why they haven't put in scripts that just randomize the name and ID of those, I don't know, but they do. You know, randomizing table prefixes, changing, you know, checking and changing file permissions, changing directory paths, obfuscating login points. So the first question I want to ask is, what got you interested in saying, I want to build a security plugin for WordPress?
Well, at the time I was working for a university. I was working for Southern Illinois University in aviation, and WordPress was a good, you know, most of our sites were Drupal. Our main site was Drupal. And WordPress was great for, you know, a multi-site. It was actually WordPress MU at that point. Excuse me. Before multi-site was in core. And it was great to allow student groups, faculty, and that to have their own sites. But I had like 20 security plugins going. I'm like, well, this is crazy because one would update and another one would break, you know, all that kind of jazz. So I started putting together one of my own. And that's what got that started. But like you say, it was all about best practices, you know, force password changes. A lot of things that are completely obsolete now, like changing the database prefix, you know, hiding the login area. There's a joke, Jeff Chandler from WP Tavern still refers to me as the asshole because of that one.
I don't know anything about that joke.
The running joke is I'm an asshole, and when we tried to release, because that feature was so stupidly complicated, when we did our first release with iThemes, we had 300 or 400 beta testers. Nobody noticed it was thoroughly broken. I estimated when I started going back through logs and tickets, it probably crashed about 10,000 sites, like completely.
Oh my God! Oh God!
it was bad. It took us a good week to really get that feature patched. But people loved the feature. I kept wanting to pull it out, and people were like, no, because it doesn't do a damn thing. But it was
God,
there.
You're such an asshole, Chris.
I was at a WordCamp Miami, and first time I met Chandler in real life, I'm talking to a bunch of guys. He walks up and he goes, so you're that asshole who crashed all those websites. Who the hell are you?
With great fame comes great responsibility.
Yeah, so, my bad code didn't crash my own site. It just crashed everybody else's. Great.
But you still, though, I mean, the tool itself, though, was inspired and obviously had a huge amount of value in taking care of, you know, security issues at the WordPress level that the app itself does not deal with. And a lot of those are things you're automating. You are, when you built it, you designed it to automate processes that, much like setting up your server, you can do on your own. And I think that's true for whether you're using WordPress, Drupal keeps coming up, whatever system you're building or using, or if you are building one, don't use admin as your admin user. Don't use ID1 as your main user. You know, these are things, you know, make sure the right directories are writable. Make sure that you are.
And they're leaving, not. The wrong directories aren't writable, or maybe it's the right directories aren't writable too, right?
Right. Yeah. Or files, you know, make sure your config files aren't publicly writable. Make sure they have the right users assigned to them. You wrote that to make that easy. And that's, you know, we were talking about certbot, and part of the magic of certbot is that it makes that process of getting that certificate easy and deploying it easy. There's nothing that it does that a normal person can't do. It just saves you having to research it and learn it. But learning that stuff, there is a huge amount of value in sitting down and understanding, okay, I'm installing this plugin to do all this workload, but I could also save myself a whole lot of execute time and things if I just change this stuff myself. Yeah. And I want to stress to folks that they should look at that as a stepping stone, not a solution. Because there are still ways to get around it.
Yeah, that's just it. Exactly. The idea of the plugin was originally enforcing best practices. I mean, there was a couple features in there. You know, we worked for a university that had night flight, was an aviation program. So the student workers at night tended to put parties on the various websites in WordPress. So there was a feature in Better WP Security, still an iTheme Security, for away mode, where you can set the hours where nobody's allowed to log in and update anything. So for an office can come in really handy for that type of attack. Huh. But, I call it an attack. It was our own students, but legitimately isn't an attack. Somebody's using the site the way they shouldn't.
I was just going to say that. Yeah. You're using it some of the way you're not supposed to.
Yeah. What was the phrase you used? Threat model.
Exactly. Our threat model was our own students in some cases. And I don't mean like they were bad people. Disclaimer, they were all good people. They had a neat way to tell all the rest of the students that were out that night where the party was, so they did. But that gets frowned upon by those above them and those in charge. And so stop it.
And I'm sure other platforms have tools that are just as good and equivalent in terms of doing those same functions. I'm not as familiar with those, so I can't speak to them, whether, you know, Drupal, if I haven't said that word enough now, I don't know what the tool is there, because I avoid Drupal like the plague. I've been burned by it on too many version updates. So, yeah. But I don't want to end the episode before we talk a little bit about Red Team. I think that's something that we need to hit on in terms of, you know, what you can learn and how to get more skills in this area.
So the episode so far, we've been doing Blue Team, which is defense. It's like DevOps and server admin and everything. It's preventative. It's learning how to defend your targets against attackers. But Red Team is the opposite. That's the attacking side.
When did we switch from Blue Team, Red Team, or from White Hat, Black Hat to Red Team, Blue Team?
I don't know, but I have a book that is called the RTFM, Red Team Field Manual. And it's like a skinny little, maybe 100-page book. And it's got all these different like easy bake commands and other things, quick reference for like Windows, Linux, Mac, etc. But it's RTFM. You know, like read the manual.
The last cert course I did on pen testing, I never heard the term red team used in it. That was a year and a half ago. So
I hear it a lot in the InfoSec groups. I do a monthly meetup and they use it a lot, but
yeah, I see a lot in social. I just don't see it too much in
groups
and things like that.
I don't know when we started using it. The equivalent of Black Hat, though.
What is our term that we want to tag this with? Is it InfoSec? Is it OpSec? Is it WebSec? What's the proper term for the general web security area?
InfoSec or WebSec, I think either one, because there's an awful lot of DevOps covered in there, right? Which is traditional InfoSec.
Yeah.
WebSec, when we start getting to the application level.
Well, actually, I said a minute ago that Black Hat was similar to Red Team. I don't think that's actually correct. White Hat is both Red and Blue Team. Black Hat would be Red Team, but with perhaps malicious intent.
Red, or black, white are intent. Red, blue are direction.
Which side you're on. Yeah. But I think that in order to understand better how to defend against things, it's good to know how to attack with them. And in the show notes, I'll put a couple links to vulnhub.com, which has a bunch of like ready-made virtual machines you can download, and then you can attack to your heart's content without running any risk of legal recourse or anything, because you're running a server, you're running the server on your own machine. So you can batter the heck out of it. And then hackthebox.eu is a free VPN lab you can connect to that gives you different machines you can try to attack and compromise and secure root access, or elevated privileges at least. The catch is with Hack the Box, to get a invitation, you actually have to do some clever, like there's no invite link directly. You have to find it. And I'm not going to disclose how to do that, because that's sort of like the, are you ready to do this stuff? If you can't solve this simple puzzle, you won't be able to solve the things inside of it. I am a member of it. I'm not great at InfoSec, but I do know that much.
No, I the first rule of Fight Club.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And second,
if you want to, and if you're looking for a path that it is a little more traditional, it doesn't require problem solving up front, there's always the SANS courses, SANS.org.
If you can afford those.
If you can afford them. If you're a web developer and you get any kind of personal development, there's some neat courses in there for pen testing and other things.
There's two things that I think are relevant, Aaron, to what you're talking about, which is one, yes, you're totally right. It's hard to learn defense if you don't know offense. And two, I would absolutely go out, find yourself a friend and say, hey, see if you can get into my box, try to break it. Mm-hmm. But I want to make sure to throw a very important caveat here. Depending on who your host is, make sure you either submit a support ticket, ask, check what their penetration testing
I would
rules
say
just and restrictions are.
Play it safe and don't have your friend attack your box if it's not hosted on your personal computer that you can physically touch. Local network.
Like, yeah. And WP Engine has this policy that, because my RCSO had asked about this, because they were wanting to bring in a third party, like a security audit service, and they wanted to ask about that. And like WP Engine, they have you submit a ticket and they will move your site into a specially housed area where it can be tested. So a lot of these hosts, whether it's DigitalOcean, WP Engine, a managed host, whatever, it's worth looking, because a lot of them do say it's okay to do it. You just have to let them know.
When I was at Cornell, we hosted our primary domains on AWS, and we had to do occasional scanning. I think we use Rapid7, just like, you know, the standard battery. And you have to let AWS know in advance, we're going to be doing pen testing during this period of time for this reason on these specific domains. Just so you know, so that they know, so they don't automatically like flag the site or shut it down or anything if it's getting targeted.
Yeah. Well, and you don't want to blacklist the people who are legitimately trying to alert you to a problem, because they will, if they are doing their job right, they should look like a bad guy.
Yeah.
But obviously they aren't. So that's something I think it's incredibly important. And you're also right that at the end of the day, if you're not sure, host it locally, you know, and to like Chris's earlier point, you know, get a Docker set up that can replicate your exact, the exact setup, the exact configuration options that should be there, so that when they hit it, they're hitting something that is equivalent in all the meaningful ways. So that, you know, apples to apples basically is what you're after.
And the other thing is a more general security topic. The idea of social engineering, of like, you know, hacking the person instead of the technology. The really great book on that is Art of Deception by Kevin Mitnick.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's,
It's old, but most of the stuff that he uses in it, like pretexting and other like tricks, are still, they're things he actually did back in the 80s and 90s, and they are still usable today.
I said it earlier. People don't scale. They also don't change.
Right.
We change much more slowly than computers do. The way you trick a person is totally different.
Well, you even think back to like the old hacker stuff when they're calling them up. And, you know, I always think of the best part of hacker is the part that lasted the longest is when he calls it up and he says, yeah, my computer is out. And, you know,
AWOL.
Yeah.
And the BLT drive.
The BLT, exactly.
It still works. But that's still,
yeah, it really does. I mean, that's if you can target anything, that's the way to do it.
I'm not going to tell you why I know it still works.
The thing that I really got from that book, though, is that it's the process of social engineering, at least from that book anyways, is like a gradual escalation, like of small increments. You have, and you kind of leverage, like, I know this much about your organization. That means you can give me this tiny bit more, right? And then you get from that, and then you know the little bit more, and you go to a different person. It's like, oh, well, I know these three people that you work with, and I'm in this office that you know is right down the hall from you. So clearly you can call me back and give me this number that I need.
Which should scare folks if you think about how much you use Facebook, LinkedIn, things
oh,
like
yeah.
that. Chris, man, I want to thank you for jumping on tonight with us. I know we've probably run, I haven't watched the clock now, and I'm sure we've ran really long, but I have enjoyed this absolutely thoroughly. I appreciate you coming on and making sure that we're keeping things straight. And I know that some folks know me as a noted security expert Kansas man, but let me tell you something. Security in Kansas is not necessarily as stringent as elsewhere in the world. So believe it or not, that's not that much of a compliment for
if
me.
Only our world was like Global Online or something.
Does that make Chris Wickman notable security expert Florida man?
Oh, God.
I don't think
I've seen any rest stories about you in the newspaper.
Hey. Well, it's better than Jeff Rowe's name for me.
The Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends at NewCloud. NewCloud is an industry-leading interactive map provider who has been building location-based solutions for organizations for a decade. Are you trying to find a simple solution to provide your users with an interactive map of your school, city, or business? Well, NewCloud's interactive map platform gives you the power to make and edit a custom interactive map in just minutes. They have a team of professional cartographers who specialize in map illustrations of many different styles and are ready to design an artistic rendering to fit your exact needs. One map serves all of your users' devices with responsive maps that are designed to scale and blend in seamlessly with your existing website. To request a demonstration or to view their portfolio, visit them online at nucloud.com/drunkenUX. That's nucloud.com/drunkenUX.
Chris, once again, I want to thank you for joining us this evening and giving us a couple hours of your time. I hope your beer was good. I hope your time with us was enjoyable and that you'll tell all your friends that this is the podcast to be on. those are some cool dudes with a loose moose. before we take off, though, I want to make sure, tell everybody, you know, what you got going on, where they can find you, what's interesting, whatever you want to say, this is your moment.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me, guys. You can find me pretty much Chris Wickman, ChrisWiegman at pretty much everything from WordPress.org to ChrisWiegman.com. Actually, as a follow-up to this, I've got a couple talks I've given which are on WordPress TV and are linked to from my own site, explaining, you know, getting started with application security and what to look for as a WordPress developer and kind of expanding on from there. So you can find me just about everywhere at Chris Wickman.
You'd almost think that WordPress is an important piece of just the web these days.
It's only 30%, you know.
I want to thank everybody for tuning in this week. Be sure to catch us coming up. We've got, of course, real-time overview every Wednesday, except when I blow my production schedule because of conferences. And we've also got something else in the works that I'm not going to tell you anything more about, except to say, just stay tuned. There is something else coming.
If you caught the strategy car episode where we were guests, hint, hint, it will be in the show notes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Go check us out on strategycar.com.
It's the thing we alluded to on there.
Yeah, we've alluded to it there as well. This is our veiled attempt at keeping people interested. So,
well, while you're staying interested with us, be sure to check us out on Facebook and Twitter / DrunkenUX and also at DrunkenUX.com. You can connect with us on Slack via drunkenux.com/slack to sign up for it.
It's Slack is a whole lot like IRC, except prettier. So
yeah.
I'm wondering if you haven't used it yet, because I'm sure most people, or if you use Discord. Discord is basically like a fun version of Slack.
Discord and Slack look almost identical.
They use the same library, that's why.
They must be, yeah.
At any rate, I can only leave you guys with one other piece of information, and that is to keep your personas close, but what your users closer.